Today we're going to look at New Testament times, just trying to fill in some of the issues. Now, it isn't my purpose to give you a great big long history of Israel up to this point. What I want to do is just kind of put you in the scene, put you in the picture, as it were. And the first thing that we need to look at, of course, is the land. Now, the land is often called on maps the land of Palestine in the New Testament or whatever. That's often how you will see it called in the maps at the back of your Bible. There's a big problem with that, and that is that it wasn't called Palestine in New Testament times. It wasn't called Palestine until the Emperor Hadrian named it Palestine in the 2nd century AD, so after New Testament times. He did that to spite the Jews. And I think it's important that we say that straight off. It's very important that we understand that we shouldn't be calling it Palestine. We should be calling it Israel, because that's what it is. And even today, we shouldn't be calling the land Palestine, because it's not Palestine. It never really was or did belong to Palestine and the Palestinians. It belonged to Israel. It was given to Israel. It has been given by deed, even if you don't interpret the Old Testament prophecies in a literal fashion. Back in the 1940s, 1948, it was given to Israel as a nation. And so we're going to talk about Israel in these studies. Now, if I forget myself and I mention the word Palestine, then just kind of humor me and replace that in your minds with the word Israel. And that's what we should be doing. The land of Israel, if you look at a map at the back of your Bible, or if you've got a Bible atlas or something like that, the land is really a very small piece of land, which is really in the center of three continents. There is Europe to the northwest, there is Africa to the southwest, and there is Asia to the north and to the east. And if you looked at a map of the world, you would see that Israel was basically right in the center of the continents of the world. Now, whether that is particularly enlightening or what you make of that, I don't know, but it is an interesting fact. There it is, right at the center of things. And I think that is not just a happenstance. That is the way that God has made the world, and he's concentrated his people right in the hub of things. That's where all of the action has been. That's certainly where all the action is going to be when the Antichrist comes on the scene, and when Christ comes back and sets up his reign on earth. Everything seems to revolve around about this little strip of land. Now, this strip of land is about the size of New Jersey. It's not very big at all. In fact, it's 45 miles wide and 145 miles long. Just think about that a minute. Where you are, if you just get in your car and you drive 145 miles, how long is that going to take you? Not very long, is it? If you drive 45 miles, well, some of you might drive 45 miles to work. I used to. So, really, you know, we're not talking about a large piece of land at all, are we? If you look from north to south, you can basically see four strips that run north to south through the land. And it kind of helps you to see some of the topography if we look at it this way. Moving from west to east, from the Mediterranean to the desert regions, but we're doing strips north to south. But let's start with the Mediterranean, and we're going to move east, okay, towards the desert. One can find these four longitudinal zones which distinguish the land. First, near the Mediterranean, there is the fertile coastal plain, which receives less rain as you move further south. Okay, so towards the north, the more mountainous region up there, Mount Carmel and so on, there's an awful lot of precipitation. As you go further south towards the Negev, underneath Israel and then towards Egypt, it receives less and less rain. this is a very fertile area. It includes the coastal plain. It's basically a strip of 115 by 20 miles. And that would include what's called the Shephelah, which is the hill country just before you get to the mountains. And you may have heard of that. We're including that in the coastal plain. So that's the first strip. The next strip is the central mountain range, running through the middle of Israel, between the coastal plain and the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. So if you look at the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee, and you come in a bit, okay, then that strip, north to south, is the central mountain range. It kind of divides the coastal plain from the valleys of the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. Then, if you find the tip of the Red Sea towards the bottom of your map and run your finger up through the Dead Sea to the Sea of Galilee and up north to Dan, if you can find that on your map, basically following the Jordan, that's what is the Rift Valley. Okay, so there's your next slice. And then finally, on the other side are the Transjordanian Mountains, which you might find Bashan to the north there, now the Golan Heights, Gilead underneath that, including a little tributary, the Jabbok, and then down to what we call the Decapolis, the Ten Cities covering ancient Moab, and then down to the Mountains of Edom. After that, you get into the desert regions. And this is why, in ancient times, you basically had to go north. If you wanted to go east, you had to go north in Israel first before you journeyed east, because you couldn't go through those desert regions. They were too harsh and too rugged. So that's basically the topography of the land. And as I say, you can drive around it basically in a day. And those that have been over there, they are just astonished at how close together everything is. You know, we need to understand that, living in a vast country like we do, where very often, you know, we don't think twice about driving 8 or 10 hours to a relative's place, or, you know, to get to where we want to go to. Well, if you did that in Israel, you'd be way outside of Israel by the time you stopped. Galilee, which is the northern part of Israel, covered an area of about 770 square miles. 770 square miles. Now, by contrast, Greater London in England covers an area of 659 square miles. So Galilee was not much larger in area than one of our largest cities in the world. The only cities in Galilee at this time were Sepphoris, Sepphoris, which was rebuilt by Herod Antipas when he came to the throne in 4 BC, and Tiberias, T-I-B-E-R-I-A-S, Tiberias, which was, I think they started to build that in about 19 AD. Each of these cities, if we can call them that, had between 10,000 and 20,000 inhabitants at that time. That's according to Eckhard Schnabel's book, Early Christian Mission, Volume 1, page 190. And these two were recently built, and they were kind of the administrative centers of that region. In fact, Tiberias was built as the new administrative center by Herod Antipas to replace Sepphoris in that role. Not sure why, perhaps he liked to be by the coast. And there was one more city in Galilee at that time, Capernaum, which you've all heard of through the Gospels, which had none of the architectural trappings of the first two cities, but rivaled them in population. Nevertheless, it needs to be said that neither Sepphoris nor Tiberius, although they did have certain architectural things in them, and they had a plan, and they had a structure more on the lines of Greco-Roman cities, neither of them were actually built as classical Greek cities, as were some of the cities in the Decapolis, which are across from the Sea of Galilee and further south, the 10 cities. So they didn't have, you know, large amphitheatres, for example, as you find in those Decapolis cities, like Gerasa and so on. You don't find, you know, the large Greco-Roman structures that you find in those cities. But they did have some of the trappings of Rome's presence. Galilee was literally spread with smaller towns and villages, though. All of these towns and villages were connected by well-worn dirt tracks. Now, if you read the older books on Galilee and the life of Christ, you will be told that Galilee was somewhat isolated, and Nazareth, for example, was somewhat isolated because it was away from the major routes, the stone paved routes that the Romans laid and so on. And the reason for that is that they hadn't at that time discovered these old dirt tracks. We now know that Galilee and all of the villages in Galilee were well connected by this intricate network of small dirt roads. And therefore, it would be quite wrong to think of a town like Nazareth, maybe just a few hundred people living there, as being isolated. They weren't at all. In fact, many of these towns and villages would depend on one another. One town might make pottery, for example. One town might make other wares, you know, deal with carpentry and so on. Another town might grow a certain grain or fruit. And they could do this because they were all interconnected, you see. The majority of the inhabitants of these villages were Jews, with the Gentiles usually residing in the cities, particularly around the Sea of Galilee, in Tiberias. Sepphoris did have a Gentile population, but it appears that it had a larger Jewish population, which I think is quite interesting. The Jews hated Sepphoris, generally, especially the villages, and I think that they hated it mainly because it was built by Herod Antipas, and it involved taxing them even more, as cities do, swallowing up the produce of the countryside. They actually, come the rebellion in the 60s, they overthrew Sepphoris and vented their anger on it. Sepphoris was just about 2 hours' walk from Nazareth, so it is very possible that Jesus and Joseph and others from Nazareth worked upon the building of Sepphoris. It is interesting to point out, and we'll come back to this, that none of these cities, not Tiberias, not Sepphoris, although they were built by somebody who wanted to ingratiate themselves with Rome, Herod Antipas, none of them are known to have been very Roman. For example, there has not been found an equestrian statue of Tiberius or an emperor in either one of these cities, which I think is quite interesting. And the reason is that the Jews didn't like these images. And they could get pretty vocal and pretty vociferous against them. And so when we are told that the Galileans in the time of Jesus were some sort of compromisers with the Gentiles, this is not the picture that has emerged from the discoveries that have been made in Galilee. Let's just say a word about the population of Israel before we get a little bit further into that. In Jesus' day, the population of the whole land was approximately 1.5 million people, maybe up to 2 million. With 500,000 Jews in Judea to the south, approximately 200,000 Jews, though some Gentiles, in Galilee at the north, and then about another 500,000 Samaritans and Gentiles in the land, scattered hither, thither, and yon. Now, the Samaritans, of course, were between the northern province of Galilee and southern Judea. There basically is that strip between those two. And so there were a lot of Samaritans that were living at that time. We, of course, know that most Jews who were traveling, either from the south to the north or north to the south, they would make a diversion around the Sea of Galilee and down the track of the Jordan in order to not pass through the land of the Samaritans. They did not like the Samaritans at all, and there are all kinds of historical reasons for that. As we've said, it would be wrong, quite wrong, to describe the Galileans as less Judaistic, as less religious than those of Judea. They certainly were just as rigorous, just as faithful to the Jewish religion as the people in the south. While they had more day-to-day contact with Gentiles than did those in Judea, they were careful not to associate too closely with Gentiles other than in necessary commerce. It has been established that Galilean Jews did not live in, nor seek entertainment in, any of those cities. Capernaum was just a large town, really. It didn't have any great organized plan and no great public buildings. But neither in Tiberias nor in Sepphoris or further south in Scythopolis, ancient Bethshan or the Decapolis, the Galileans were strict in their observance of the Torah and of the purification laws. We have to understand that Judaism is not the same as being Israelite. Of course, those who were Jews and who observed Judaism were Israelites, I understand that. But Judaism is a reactionary movement. And that's how it should be seen. It should be seen as a movement of the people who were Israelites to maintain their national and cultural and religious identity. And it stemmed, of course, from the previous history of people like Antiochus Epiphanes and so on, back in the 2nd century BC, the influence of Rome, who tried to change and influence the Jews. Well, they reacted against that. And the Hasmonean dynasty of the Maccabees and those following in the couple of centuries before Christ, they were very much involved in maintaining as much as possible the identity of the people, especially as focused in the temple. And so this is where Judaism came from. Judaism is not the same as Old Testament Jewishness. Now, it has similarities, of course. It has overlap, but it's not the same because it's a reactionary movement, okay, to maintain their identity. I say that because we have to understand that whether from the north or from the south, the Jews had that Judaistic identity and that Judaistic mindset. And that's what made them wary of the Samaritans, and that's what made them wary of the Gentiles. They really saw themselves as being God's chosen people, as interpreted generally through the teaching of the scribes and the rabbis. I'm going to say a word here about the synagogue. I'm not going to go into it too much. We'll probably cover it as we go through. But just to say that Scholars have generally argued about whether synagogues actually existed in Israel before AD 70. You may know that in AD 70, of course, the Romans finally had had enough of the Jewish rebellions, which started in AD 66, and they completely trounced and overthrew Israel, and they demolished Jerusalem and the temple. They executed many, many, many Jews at that time, and exiled many more. And in order to kind of pick up the Jewish religion, it was believed that synagogues started to form, five Jewish families and so on, could start one, as a way of maintaining that Jewish identity that we've been talking about. But, of course, the New Testament talks about synagogues being in existence prior to AD 70. And so is there a discrepancy here? No, there certainly isn't. It's just that we have to understand that synagogues many times would be formed in one of the larger houses in the towns or villages. And because they were house synagogues, then of course you don't find the formal building. And we also have to remember that the destruction of these cities and then just the wear of time has eroded the traces of these particular structures. For example, in Capernaum, there is a well-known synagogue structure that dates from the 4th century AD, but it's built upon synagogue structures that probably went back to the 1st century AD. And so because of that, of course, because of the aging and the different history of the land and all that it's been through, of course, what with the Crusades and so on and so forth, with the Muslims taking over for a long time up until the Ottomans in the 19th century. Obviously, it shouldn't be too surprising that you don't find these houses anymore, but they were there. And so most conservative scholars would agree that there were synagogues, and the New Testament is quite right in reporting about their existence in the Gospels. Just a word here, we're talking generally about the land. We cannot go on without saying something about Jerusalem. Jerusalem was one of the most famous cities in the whole Roman Empire. And though not as big and grand as Rome or Alexandria or Ephesus or Antioch, each of which had a population of 500,000 up to 1,000,000, it did have more visitors per year than any of them, and was a very famous city in the Roman Empire. By the death of Herod in 4 BC, it had a population of about 40,000 people. But this may have doubled by the time of its destruction in AD 70. So we're talking about 80,000 people living in Jerusalem at the time it was overthrown. And perhaps this is why we can understand why Tacitus, for example, in his histories, he talks about literally hundreds of people being crucified, every week at that time, in so much that you couldn't find a tree around Jerusalem. They were all used for crucifying people. And because of that, we understand how many people were living there. I think that's not a stretch of the imagination to understand that. We'll be coming back to Jerusalem, of course, when we look at the temple in a few minutes' time. But just to say that it was a very important city, and it was certainly one that, because of the Roman interest in Israel, was one that Rome always kept an eye on, as well as being famous for its temple and its religious worship. We ought to say that perhaps up to 500,000 pilgrims per year came to Jerusalem. And so it was a very well-known point of destination. Well, we'll say a little bit more. We've got to look at political factors and religious factors in this study of New Testament times, but we're out of time in this particular lecture, And so I hope you've got all of your notes. Make sure, this is a required thing in Veritas, make sure that you have good notes. Notes are essential. Not just because we're hard taskmasters, but they're important to you to make sure you get that material.